to another exciting episode of Deterrence Down Under, a podcast dedicated to Australia and the challenges of deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region. Deterrence Down Under is part of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies podcasting network, where we strive to promote peace, foster strategic stability, and help you to think deterrence. Just a friendly reminder that the opinions expressed by our hosts and guests are their own and don't necessarily reflect any institution with which they may be affiliated. G'day from Canberra. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Hey, hey, I'm Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And welcome to another fabulous episode of Deterrence Down Under. I am especially honored and delighted today. We are hosting Dr. Mariana Bujerin. She is a fellow nuclear historian at Harvard University, no less. She has written a book recently with Johns Hopkins University Press. It's called Inheriting the Bomb: The Collapse of the USSR and the Nuclear Disarmament of Ukraine. She has published on Russia's war on Ukraine, the credibility of security assurances in exchange for giving up nuclear weapons. She's published on the international nuclear non-proliferation regime, arms control, nuclear crises, and post-Soviet nuclear history. Her current research focuses on nuclear safety and security risks to civilian nuclear reactors in armed conflict. And she has seen some stuff, people. So we are delighted to have her with us today. It's a great honor to have you, Mariana. Thank you so much. Mariana, we actually met at a nuclear history conference in Switzerland 10 years ago.
Indeed, we have 11 years ago.
11 years ago.
It was quite a surreal occurrence because it was right during the Russian takeover of Crimea, and I was presenting on Ukraine's nuclear disarmament and security commitments from nuclear states, including Russia, to Ukraine in exchange for its decision to disarm. As I was watching in real time at that conference in Switzerland, as Russian little green men, military without insignia, were taking over part of Ukraine's territory. Yeah,
absolutely. And it was a great honor. You know, we kind of immediately became friends because we both just got off the plane from the US and we're like, let's go for a bike ride. And I'm very proud to say that when we were back in Boston together, you were at Harvard, I was at MIT. We both protested, went to a protest in Harvard Square against the Russian annexation of Crimea. So here we are today, fortunately and unfortunately. Welcome to our podcast. Mariana, we would love for you to take us on a journey. Please tell us why you wrote this wonderful and extremely well-written book. What are some of the key themes and concepts that you bring to this story?
Well, this book was a journey, Christine, as most books are, right? It started way before the topic of Ukraine's nuclear disarmament was relevant or even interesting to most people in our field, in the field of nuclear history. This was, the story of what happened to Ukraine's nuclear arsenal, but also to that of Kazakhstan and Belarus, the other two nuclear inheritors, outside of Russia, after the Soviet collapse, was really quite marginal, I found at the time, to nuclear history and nuclear policy writ large before 2014. So I actually had to really stand up and argue at my department, my PhD department, my program, to try and convince folks why is it still interesting, why there's more to be learned, but why this topic might be still relevant. relevant. Now, in a few years after 2014, people stopped asking why Ukraine's nuclear disarmament is still relevant, and rather try and find out what exactly has happened. So this book has shifted sort of from more of a political science-y and IR project, where I looked at the role of international norms, but guided by developing events, I decided to look more squarely at the actual history, at the empirics, at what has happened in more detail in Ukraine specifically. So the outcome of this search and this research was my PhD dissertation, and later on, a book on Ukraine's nuclear disarmament. And, you know, when I started this research, I really encountered sort of two main narratives or two main positions on Ukraine's disarmament, right? One that came from Ukrainians mostly was that Ukraine inherited the world's third largest nuclear arsenal and gave it up in exchange for nothing but empty promises, right? So that was kind of a simple narrative on that side. On the other extreme, as it were, especially in the United States, and even among some of the people who were involved in the process of negotiating, who remembered those events firsthand, the narrative was, well, those weren't even Ukrainian weapons to give up. Those were Soviet weapons, maybe even Russian weapons, and those weapons were repatriated, so returned to their home of Russia. And Ukraine was really, it didn't have much choice but to do what it did. So the outcome of disarmament, as we say in social sciences, was overdetermined. So there really was no other way to go about it. And as someone who spent an embarrassingly long time researching this and then even more time writing about it, you know, I found that the truth is somewhere in the middle. It is much more nuanced and more complicated than either one of these two simple narratives. That Ukraine did have agency in the process, and it did have options. And even if those options weren't to just hold on to whatever weapons that Ukraine inherited, right? So what Ukraine inherited was it was true, it wasn't a ready-to-go nuclear deterrent, right, that it could just easily use to deter Russia. It still had to invest quite a bit. It still had to do quite a bit of work in order to turn that inheritance into a fully-fledged nuclear deterrent. But Ukraine equally was not just some kind of backwater agricultural country growing sunflowers and wheat. I mean, it did grow sunflowers and wheat, but it was also an industrial heartland and a site of very important military industrial enterprises of the Soviet Union, and the site, you know, the home of some very good nuclear science. So Ukraine certainly had a lot of components, what I like to call a good proliferator starter package, to go about developing a nuclear arsenal, should it have chosen to do that.
That's fantastic. A starter package. Can we get a meme about that, please? Great. I think just I wouldn't mind, before I get into more sort of conceptual questions, and Natalie's going to help me on this, aren't you, Natalie? I'm just wanting to get a sense of how you're feeling as a Ukrainian and a nuclear historian, you know, the sort of personal amount of this sort of horrific situation that we find ourselves in, ourselves, the quote-unquote the West, democratic states. I mean, we in Australia, we watch this on TV, and it's kind of this shock and horror, like, how could this possibly happen again, this sort of, you know, war between major nation states. I'm just wondering to get a sense of your feelings about what's going on.
Well, I think it won't be shocking to say that it has been a really difficult 3 years. for me personally, not least because my work is connected to security issues, is connected to nuclear aspects of what's going on. So Russia's nuclear threats and the threats to civilian nuclear facilities, as you mentioned. So I really don't have the luxury of tuning out and giving myself a psychological break, kind of detox from all this onslaught of really terrible news. And also, I still have family in Ukraine. My mom lives in Western Ukraine, cousin. Many of my friends are all over the country. So, all of us Ukrainians have lost someone in the war already. Many people have evacuated and are now refugees. So this has been certainly, the world has gone topsy-turvy. It really upended a lot of the sense of security and continuity and thinking that you know what tomorrow is going to be like. Having said that, as I think it was Dickens who wrote that, the best of times and the worst of times, and that is certainly applies to the war. It is a terrible, terrible time. Heinous, vile things are taking place, even in the conduct of this war. The war crimes, the mass graves, the gang rapes, the abduction of children. I mean, it's not just that it's an illegal war because it's a war of aggression by any, standard, any account. It's also illegally fought. It's fought in breach of any rules and norms of armed conflict that we thought we had sort of agreed upon, that, we had that down. But at the same time, it is also the time when you see the best of people. You see the bravery, you see the resilience, you see people helping each other. You see the solidarity, as you mentioned, even from faraway places like Australia. And I have to say to your listeners, every little bit helps. It does. Even feel what you feel inside, any way you choose to express the solidarity, not just for the sake of Ukraine, but for the sake of just keeping some kind of sense of what is right and wrong in this world, right? So all of that is been going on all at the same time, and that's about the shortest I can answer that.
Mariana, would you be able to sort of talk us through the trilateral statement? So in January 14, 1994, Ukraine committed committed to full disarmament, including the strategic weapons, in exchange for economic support and security assurances from the United States and Russia. So when we're talking about these economic support and security assurances from the United States and what we're seeing now with President Trump, could you talk to some of that? And do you feel that, or what's the sentiment in Ukraine about, particularly around that economic support as well? Because we're seeing Trump pull lots of economic funding there.
Right. So there's a lot in that. So you mentioned the trilateral statement, and that really was the framework, the broader framework, the outline of basically a nuclear deal with Ukraine that was negotiated between Ukraine, the United States, and Russia. And that was a product of a rather prolonged negotiations where Ukraine tried to hold her own at the time, which was no easy task, sitting across the negotiating table with two nuclear powers that saw eye to eye. Frankly, they were in collusion on the issue of Ukraine's nuclear disarmament and wanted to see it disarmed completely. And Ukraine was able to get basically a deal, even though the starting point of, say, a state like Russia was that, what kind of deal can we talk about? These are not even Ukrainian weapons to give up. They belong to us. We just want our property back. So that, despite what might be said today, the trilateral statement and later on what became known as the Budapest Memorandum, which was just the security assurance part of what was already spelled out in the trilateral statement, that was still an accomplishment. That was an accomplishment of Ukrainian diplomacy. It was an accomplishment of Ukrainian negotiating process. And it included compensation for the fissile material, so for nuclear material that was contained in the warheads that Ukraine was giving up, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. So there was a calculation on how to basically account for that material in terms of low-enriched uranium that would be supplied to Ukraine as part of fuel assemblies for its nuclear power plants. That was the compensation for the nuclear material. There was technical assistance for dismantling the launch vehicles, so missiles and strategic bombers, right? Armaments cost money, but disarmament also costs money. So some you need to pay somehow for cutting up these things and recultivating the land and all of that. And that was achieved with U.S. technical assistance and support. And then there was a pledge of economic cooperation and assistance. And that was quite important to Ukraine at the time, because in the early 1990s, Ukraine was in a rather dire economic situation in the middle of a transition, post-Soviet transition crisis, right? Inflation, I was a student in Kyiv at that time, and I remember inflation was about 10,000% a year. It was hard, right? So these were hard times. And so Ukraine needed structural funds from international financial institutions such as the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, to try to help it stabilize the economy, introduce permanent currency, the hryvnia, which was ultimately introduced in 1996, and generally help out with the economy. And of course, as we know, the United States plays an outsized role in these international financial institutions. So that was very important for Ukraine to negotiate this kind of financial assistance. But equally important was the security part of it. Right, Ukraine understood that it was giving up an option, right? Perhaps not a fully fledged deterrent, but an option to which it felt entitled, rightfully, as the legal successor state of a nuclear weapon state, which was the Soviet Union under the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. Right, there was, you know, USSR was one of the five recognized nuclear weapon states. It suddenly fell apart into these constitutive parts. And of course, it was taken for granted that Russia would be the successor to its place under the NPT. But equally, Ukraine argued, that doesn't disqualify us completely from having a legitimate claim to this inheritance. We, you know, Ukraine did not acquire these weapons, you know, in breach of any international norms as a violator of international non-proliferation regime. It was a rightful part and part of contributed resources to a nuclear program of a nuclear recognized nuclear weapon state. So, you know, in recognition that it was giving up the strategic option, right, and that it was increasingly feeling under threat from its more powerful northern neighbor, Russia, you know, so the sort of disputes, tensions over Crimea and the division of the Black Sea Fleet were already on the way. There was really never a full acceptance on the Russian part of Ukraine's independence and sovereignty, even amongst the Russian liberals, the surrounding of, you know, allegedly democratic Russian President Boris Yeltsin, who preceded Putin. Ukraine was really set on getting robust security guarantees, and that's what Ukrainians wanted, out of the nuclear weapon state. And that some of that got written down in the trilateral statement, but really the document that kind of took that in a separate and, you know, formalized it in a separate format and tied it to Ukraine's accession to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was the Budapest Memorandum that was signed almost a year later after the trilateral statement in December 1994. And that, today in Ukraine, is a really much, rather an infamous document, not surprisingly. because, of course, under that document, the nuclear powers that were the three nuclear powers that were depository states of the NPT, right, the United Kingdom, United States, and Russia as a successor of the USSR, pledged to respect Ukraine's international borders, independence and sovereignty, not to use threaten military force, any military force, not just nuclear, against Ukraine, not to resort to economic coercion, and of course, as you mentioned, the NPT-related negative and positive security assurances, nuclear security assurances. And that is, of course, the document that was very glibly and brutally violated by Russia. And some might say in Ukraine, not entirely the West, the other signatories, Western signatories, haven't really stepped up to the spirit of this document either.
And could you also talk us through some of those negative security assurances that where Russia did agree in 1978 and 1995 that it would not attack a non-nuclear weapon state. However, in 1995, it stated that those pledges would not apply in the case of an invasion or any other attack on the Russian Federation territory, its armed forces or other troops, its allies, or in a state towards which it has a security commitment carried out and sustained by such a non-nuclear weapon state in association or an alliance with nuclear weapon state. And in 2024, it reaffirmed this exception to the general negative security assurances. Now, obviously, Ukraine didn't attack Russia. Russia attacked Ukraine. So then, can you please interpret this for me?
The issue of security assurances, these NPT-related security assurances from NPT nuclear weapon states, all of them have formulated some kind of form of this kind of negative security assurance not to attack or threaten a non-nuclear weapon state party to the NPT with nuclear weapons. These are political assurances. Yes, they're pledged. They're part of the non-proliferation regime, but the non-nuclear states were not successful even back in the day when the treaty was negotiated of having them formalized as part and parcel of the treaty, right? The letter of the treaty. There is no article on security assurances as part of the NPT. And there's a good reason for that. And that is that nuclear states want to kind of keep their options open. And that's also the reason for all these qualifications. Nuclear states have allies to whom they extend, their extended deterrence and security assurance. And of course, if that ally finds itself in a conflict with the nuclear state, then of course the nuclear state reserved the right to retaliate. This revised Russian nuclear doctrine that just came out in October, I think, of 2024. There really isn't much new in it other than to say, Russia has lowered somewhat, not as drastically as some people would make it, I would say, but somewhat lowered the nuclear threshold and reiterated, I think, specifically with Ukraine in mind, that, if it deems that Ukraine is allied with the Western, alliance, which formally, of course, Ukraine is not, but, there's ample room for interpretation for Mr. Putin to engage in his own, reading of the situation. It's one of those, it's one of the latest iterations in a series of nuclear signaling that Russia has engaged in since the beginning of this war.
Those are excellent points, Mariana. I'm laughing and sort of crying at the same time. it is very, very interesting. And, for our Australian listeners, it's interesting. Here in Canberra, this is not to be glib by any means, but Ukraine is kind of the big and shiny thing in terms of warfare, lessons learned, etc., which I can understand. But, Australia is in a maritime theater. But the core concepts and ideas are still relevant in terms of you know, what do security assurances, whether they be positive or negative, what do they actually mean? How are they interpreted and so forth? And, you know, to what extent can Australia, you know, believe countries such as the United States when it comes to positive security assurances, such as extended deterrence implied through the ANZUS Treaty? That is a great question. And I was writing a little op-ed with another Australian academic, Peter Layton, who's a legend, fellow Queenslander, about, you know, Trump is kind of the cherry on top of the cake of the structural changes that are happening in the international system. Like, yes, Trump is disruptive, but he is but an accentuating factor in the grinding of the tectonic plates of the shifting international order that we're currently witnessing with the Russian aggression against Ukraine and Europe, Chinese military expansion, et cetera, et cetera. Your ambassador, Vasyl Miroshnichenko, has been really doing a great job here in Canberra advocating for Ukraine. I'm just interested, sorry, I'm waffling a bit. I haven't had enough coffee. do you have thoughts, views, perceptions, perspectives on the value, I know this is a bit of a big question, of positive or negative security assurances? What kind of thoughts do you have for our Australian listeners who are looking at kind of, you know, what is the value of U.S. security guarantees in this, given these structural and political challenges that the U.S. faces today?
Well, I would start by saying that, of course, Australia's situation is different than Ukraine's situation. Ukraine was not a treaty ally. It had assurances, not security guarantees. And for the United States, you know, under most administration, that made a difference, right? A security guarantee was something more robust, and it came with sort of an implied defense commitment, mutual defense commitment. Now, to what extent and how that would be carried out is another question. But Ukraine was explicitly not given that. And Ukrainians sort of knew it, at least those Ukrainians who negotiated. I think Ukrainians for themselves are realizing, you know, there has been a lot of talk about, you know, whether Ukrainian leadership was naive and misguided to have made that decision back then, and whether they knew that they were going to be duped and getting only assurances but not guarantees and so forth. I mean, there's a whole book that you can read about that. But I suppose my conclusion is that Ukraine essentially put stock in the international system. And if that was naive at the time, then yes, Ukraine was naive. Now, Ukraine put stock in the system of, in the what we call rule, quote unquote, rules-based international order, with the UN as a sort of the main forum, but also the non-proliferation regime as something that, you know, states would honor and preserve, and certainly pledges made in connection with the non-proliferation regime would be honored and observed. But I think Ukrainians have learned the hard way that those structures are only as good as the big powers choose to remain restrained. They have, if they choose otherwise, you know, and we're talking about big powers. If they choose otherwise, if they choose to go rogue, there's very little that smaller powers could do. And they could hone alliances. I mean, most of the time that kind of worked, right? To work on your alliances with the bigger, with the more powerful patron, to have joint military planning, to have, you know, look at NATO. I mean, there's decades of work behind Article 5, right? It's not what Article 5 really says. I mean, it's a very short formulation. And honestly, I don't think it really matters if it's legally binding or not. It's the operationalization of it it's decades of force deployments, U.S. bases, the joint command, the joint planning groups, the exercises together, all of that, that provides an assurance, you know. And even then, what we see going on in Europe is a huge degree of very justified skepticism as to the extent to which at least this administration in the United States would honor any sort of commitments to their allied security. And so for Ukrainians, it's the lessons are, you know, rely only on yourself and arm.
Definitely would agree there. I think we're going to see a proliferated Europe, which these things were meant to prevent. And maybe even a proliferated Asia. But the US has got all the nukes, right?
No, fantastic points, Mariana. Like, I love, this is partly why we're friends. We marry conceptual and historical and empirical. It's just good. It's just fantastic. John Mearsheimer is probably, you know, having a bottle of champagne right now in terms of, you know, structural realism and so forth. Sad, very, very sad. But true. We'll have to wrap it up shortly, but Mariana, I want to showcase some of the incredible work that you're working on right now. You know, we were talking over Zoom recently. Please tell us about your current work on nuclear security and safety. It's fascinating.
So that stemmed from, you know, this unprecedented fact that Russia attacked and took over and occupied a nuclear power plant in Ukraine, Europe's largest Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine, with six gigawatt nuclear power plant, and it's still under Russian control. And so in this, the story actually has enormous importance for the development of nuclear energy worldwide. And we meaning, you know, international community in many countries have been looking to nuclear energy as a way to mitigate climate change and, you know, the next generation of nuclear reactors and so forth. And suddenly we find that, you know, something we thought was impossible, which was, you know, firing rounds from artillery and tanks at operating nuclear reactors becomes a reality. But more than just the damage, I mean, not to minimize that, the damage to, you know, reactors or equipment or buildings on that site, what emerged as an unprecedented issue for nuclear security and safety is the plight of the staff of the nuclear power plant. Because if you think about it, you might have all of the protocols, you might have your safety, you know, procedures down to a T, and you might have all of the equipment in the best of working orders. But if your operators are working under the barrels of a gun of a hostile military force, people with Kalashnikovs in your control rooms, right? If you're a nuclear operator, there's a limit to which you can, you know, carry out this really demanding work, in good faith, of course. And so my project now focuses on documenting this process of takeover from oral history interviews, talking to people who have evacuated from Zaporizhzhia, but who have spent time, who were there during the takeover, and who have spent some time working under the Russian occupation. And I have to tell you that it's a very difficult project because some of these people have been detained. Some of them have been tortured. And these, you know, these are not military. These are people who, you know, they're nuclear engineers or they're safety experts or, you know, electricians or, you know, doing various jobs. And they have basically become a target of this occupying force. And so the idea is to one, record it the best we can so we know what happened, but also to glean lessons for what could be done. How could operators, but also states, nations, but also internationally, you know, international community, including the IAEA institutions like that, how could we better prepare to prevent and mitigate anything similar in the future?
Yeah, fantastic. I can't imagine what that must, the experiences and stories that you're hearing. I remember a couple of years, when it started, I was working in the Australian government, and one of my bosses said, I can't believe this is happening. It's like, well, you know, war is unfortunately a constant in international history. It's kind of a smack in the face for Australia. It's like, well, you know, this could happen to us, unfortunately. And it's just, I'm just so very, very sad that Ukraine is experiencing this. The Australian people, I'm sure we all stand for Ukraine's safety, sovereignty, independence going forward, and we hope that this horrific war will end soon on terms that are favorable to Ukraine. Mariana, thank you so very much for coming on our show. I'm about to cry.
Thank you so much for having me, and you know, thank you to all of you, all of the listeners, and all of the Australians who have in word and deed and even in thought supported Ukraine.
I can't remember what exact capabilities we have given to Ukraine, but we've sent over a few bits of kit, which I hope has been useful. Natalie, unless you have any final thoughts.
No, thank you very much, Mariana. It's been lovely to talk with you today. Thanks, Christine, as well, for hosting us.
Oh, my pleasure. Our pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, all the three of us, us fabulous women, nuclear women. We'll have to leave it there, but thank you so very much. Thank you to our listeners. We know you're out there. We hear you. Thank you for reaching out. We're very grateful. And hit up Mariana at Harvard. Her contact details are on the Harvard website. She does amazing work, very, very cool stuff. Don't forget to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to Deterrence Down Under. Please take a minute to review the podcast, as your reviews help our podcast reach more listeners and expand the debate about strategic issues facing Australia and the region. Our show is made possible by the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization that relies upon donations to produce this podcast and spread awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can find a wide range of NIDS podcasts at thinkdeterrence.com. If you have any questions or feedback, feel free to send us an email at ddu@thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, and our sponsors, and all the amazing members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.